Live to See It, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, I'm doing great. Got to Wednesday this week, and part two of our new series, right?
Yeah, we're on part two of Signs of Progress, and part two I've called it Being Human 2.0. We're going to talk a little bit about progress as it relates to health and longevity. Thought this was a perfect topic for Thanksgiving Eve. You know, this is
You want
to talk about stuff to be thankful for, and we got three. Do we have three or four? Four really good stories here tonight. So we gotta just pound right through this stuff because they're all pretty awesome, each one in its own way. The first one is related to heart failure. Two chemicals boost cardiac regeneration in mice with heart failure. This is really interesting research, obviously, in mice, talking about basically turning scar tissue in the heart, cardiac muscle, scar tissue, back into healthy scar tissue. This is a new approach to doing something basically very regenerative within the heart of the mouse. And what you can go ahead.
I was just, 10 years ago, if someone, whether it be a human or a mouse, had heart damage, that was a permanent problem. I mean, it didn't get any better. You dealt with what heart you had left and until you were gone, right? I mean, that's it.
Heart failure is very much, even today, viewed as kind of a one-way street. You know, I mean, there's a certain amount that they can do, but, we dealt with this with my father, actually, last year, leading up to his passing. In addition to all the issues he had had with cancer, it was just this ongoing heart failure. You know, the heart was more and more damaged. It's getting weaker and weaker. And it's like, well, what can you do? And you know, the doctor just looks at you. It's like, nothing. You know, there's nothing you can do to put a damaged heart back together. But it turns out there is, or there will be. The way to do that is you take this damaged tissue, you take the tissue that has failed, and you replace it with healthy tissue. And that sounds simplistic, but that principle is the heart of so much of what we're talking about when we talk about stem cell research, when we talk about really any form of regenerative medicine. And this is a great proof of concept here that it can be done, that you can go in and reprogram connective tissue cells and turn them into healthy heart cells and take a heart that's been damaged, that should be on that kind of, one-way trip to not working at all anymore, and turn it back into a healthy heart. It's an extremely encouraging piece of research.
Well, just reading quick little quote from the article, three transcription factors are needed to reprogram connective tissue cells to become heart cells in mice, according to the statement. And the transcription factors are GATA, or GATA4, MEF2C, and TBOX5, it would appear. And so basically using these, like you say, these chemicals, you can basically ask the body to fix itself there. And that's huge. That is huge for so many people. And
this goes to a topic that we were on a couple weeks ago. We were talking about the end of organ donation and the traditional model of transplanting organs that we'll eventually come to in time, where people will be able to grow whole new hearts, whole new kidneys, livers, whatever they need from their own stem cells. And if they need a transplant, they'll be able to you know, they'll be able to transplant for the ones they have. And I was talking about how that technology represents this real way forward for, you know, keeping a person young, for basically keeping a human body young. And you countered with, and I thought this was true, that ultimately you don't want to be doing that. You don't want the trauma of pulling organs out and putting new ones in. You want to be able to refine these treatments to the point that you're actually repairing, you know, old organs and making them healthy and young again. And that's
right.
Really, I think, what we're seeing here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so it's, you know, at some point in the process, maybe we're growing hearts and vats, you know, from your own stem cells or whatever for transplant because you need a new heart or something. But yeah, but much better would be not having to crack your chest open,
right?
And to do the same, you know, to really get at that bad kidney or whatever. What if we could just take what you have and repair it? And this is part of what we're looking at here. This is a path to that. So this is pretty great.
It really is. You know, there's so many ways that fiddling around, you know, not that that's the right term, but adjusting stem cells can. There's so many different things it can treat. So many things it's good for. We've talked about, you know, nerve damage and spinal cord damage and just any number of different kinds of trauma. But this is something that basically, if nothing else happens to you, this happens to you, right? The heart fails. This is, kind of the ultimate, if you don't die of anything else, you die of this, right? I know from the statistics, for example, that heart disease is the number one killer of women in the country, right? I'm reminded of that every year during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, right? That we don't have a heart disease awareness month, right? So the heart breaking down ultimately is the thing that kills more people than just about anything else. And,
yeah,
you know, when you can make progress here, you're making progress on saving a lot of lives and keeping a lot of lives, I don't know, viable and healthy for a lot longer. This goes to not only extending life, but I think extending health span as well. That's part of what makes it so exciting.
Well, we got another one that's exciting too, Phil. The blood of the young might really be an anti-aging elixir, research shows. This is kind of gross and maybe a little frightening, but also
a little bit
exciting at the same time.
A little bit tales of the paranormal there, but it turns out actually if you follow the link and read this article, it's fantastic. They talk about going back to medieval times, you know, probably ancient times too, people have tried to make this work in horrible ways, right? In terms of the idea that there might be something in the blood of the young that would restore health and youth to an older person. But as gruesome as some of those things were, it turns out the principle is, in fact, not wrong. And we know that, who is it? Peter Thiel, I guess, has recently been on the record that he's doing this and is a big proponent of this, actually getting transfusions from, getting blood of young people kind of transfused into his veins as an aging therapy. Well, here's, evidence that this actually works. There's actually evidence going back for quite some time. There's an experiment involving blood sharing between mice of different ages that I guess scientists have been doing for a long time that shows exactly the kinds of benefits that can potentially be enjoyed through this kind of transfusion. What happens when an old mouse gets a young mouse's blood? Well, suddenly that mouse has increased synaptic activity. It starts growing nerves again. It becomes younger in a lot of mental ways and potentially physical ways as well. You can turn an old mouse into a young mouse by sharing the blood of a young mouse with that older mouse.
Well, you can see why this would make people queasy, though. I mean, the idea that an old billionaire uses his money to prey upon, you know, poor young people to literally take the blood from their veins to, you know, and you know, I'm being dramatic overly, but that's sort of the queasiness involved in this. But what if instead of, you know, taking someone else's blood, you know, what if I was able to clone my own blood into great new young blood and transfuse myself, you know, once a week or whatever with cloned blood that was, you know, that was brand new, young. I think, you know, that's when it starts getting great, right?
Or if your clone blood couldn't do it because you're old, you know, just, you know, one blood draw off a young person and then just keep cloning that blood, right? But somehow that should work, right? There should be some way to do it where it's not this process of the old, in a very real sense, preying on on the young, right? I mean, to go back to your concern, I don't think there's any way to tell the Peter Thiel story without it coming off at least a little creepy, right? I mean,
yeah. I admire Peter Thiel, but I don't think I'd be telling that story. I really don't, if I were him. But whatever.
Well, he believes in the concept, and he wants to get the idea out there. And I think it's a sound idea.
And perhaps by getting the idea out there, there'll be better ways, like what we're talking about, cloning.
The bottom line is, in the future, there's going to be more old people than young. So this would never work, right? There's not going to be enough young people to provide the blood. You know, it would just be the billionaires who'd be able to afford it. And it's just, you know, I'm just picturing horrible dystopian scenarios here. But once it can be synthesized, once you understand what it is that's going on, and you have to, you know, you have to look at what's happening inside the body of the older person who's receiving that blood. Once you understand what the elements, the particular catalysts within that younger blood and how they're interacting with the older organism, then you just start producing that. It might not even be blood, right? It might just be a supplement that you could make. But if you could clone blood, and keep transfusing it, whatever the ultimate technique for providing the therapy is, it doesn't have to be this. Whatever that ultimate thing is, we're starting to see hints of it here. Because, I mean, you don't talk about gruesome, you know, what they're doing with the mice. I didn't really go into detail there. But basically, they're connecting one mouse's circulatory system to the other mouse, right? They're kind of grafting these two mice together, as I read it. You know, that's like something out of a cheap 70s horror movie right there. I mean, that's just, you know.
Yeah.
that's just horrible. I don't think anybody would go for a plan like that. What Peter Thiel is doing is obviously a step far removed from that. And what we're saying is that the ultimate treatments that are going to result from this, the things that are going to benefit all of us, will be a far step removed from there too. But the principle is sound. And yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I'm hoping that some kind of young blood therapy will be available for me here in a few years. I feel like I could use some right now, to tell you the truth. But I think I think 10, 15 years from now, I'll be feeling the same way, if not more so.
I'm reminded of a song from my youth, Hot-Blooded, right?
Check it and see.
Right, well, that's what we want to have, be hot-blooded.
That's right.
Okay, the next one we got tonight is the CRISPR gene editing tool is finally being used in humans. And this is, you know, we've been talking CRISPR for a little while now, Phil. It seems like at least a couple of years, you know, that we've been talking about how this is, you know, ultimately sort of a word processor for genes. It allows, them to make very precise changes to the genome, and now it's being done in a particular person with an aggressive form of lung cancer. Is that right?
That's exactly right. This is really a landmark treatment that's occurring here. You know, what's happening is they're using CRISPR to make basically to make cells more resilient against cancer. They're making CRISPR to create a whole new batch of immune cells with the thought that those will go in there, they're going to reproduce, and they're going to take on this cancer. Now, there have been similar kinds of treatments. I mean, this is not a brand new treatment in the sense that nothing like this has ever been tried before, but this is the first time CRISPR has been used. So there's this much more direct interface this much more precise ability to, I mean, the word processor analogy is really helpful, I think, here in terms of understanding what's happening. You think about just basically going in and writing code, you know, to program the blood, right? To program the organism. That's what they're doing. They're writing code to program the immune system to make it strong against the cancer. We don't know, you know, hopefully it works out for the patient. We hope for a positive outcome anytime something like this is tried. But the results within the medical community, you know, the impact of this is going to be huge either way. What they're talking about here is this is going to be, there's a Sputnik analogy that's used here, right? One of the researchers says that, well, now everybody is going to have to do this, right? It's
yeah.
Very interesting
well,
to me that this is, go ahead.
You were about to say what I was about to say, Phil. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted.
It's just very interesting to me this is happening in China. Is that what you were going to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was saying. I mean, it's Sputnik because it's China. China's doing this. Oh, my God, we got to do it, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, how did they get ahead of us, right? And if you look at it, the question from the right stuff, right? If you look at it, well, they've been ahead of us. And they are consistently showing an interest in and a commitment to these kinds of technologies that we need to catch up on very much. There is a real hesitancy and reluctance around biotech in the U.S. that we need to get over, okay? Because these breakthroughs should be occurring here as much as anywhere. I mean, it's great that it's happening in China. I'm not saying China shouldn't be doing it, but I'm saying if they're doing it, we should already be doing it, right? That's the way, that, you know, call it national pride or whatever. I just feel like we should be ahead of the curve on this. We shouldn't be looking at them and responding. That is very much a
and if we want to be involved in the ethical, debate on this, it seems to me the best position to be in, if you want to take a leadership role on the ethics of something like this, is to be in the science too. You know, you don't want to be lecturing from the sidelines, right? You want to be out on the field playing the game too, and then you can lay down what the rules ought to be. Seems to me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
As a player, not as just preaching from the sidelines. I think that we'd be in a better position to be a leader in that regard if that's something that concerns us, and it should. I think the ethics of this should concern us, but being absent from it should concern us even more, I think.
Well, to me, I look at this and I say, how wrapped around the ethics do we want to get? I look at it and I say, this patient has an aggressive form of lung cancer. What do you got for him? Okay. Right. You know, if you're concerned about ethics, what can you do for this patient? Because
well,
if I were that patient,
I say an ethical argument can be made that we do everything we can do.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, if this person is going to die anyway.
Right.
Give them a shot. Let them roll the dice. Even if chances 1 in 100, give them that 1 in 100 shot. You know, if they want to take the 1 in 100 shot, let them have it.
And I
guarantee you, someone that's dying of something like this, you know, if you give them the 1 in 100 shot and tell them, look, you know, it's just that's how remote your chances are here. But you know what? We'll also advance the science, even if we can't save you. They're still going to say, "Okay, let's do it." I want this to mean something, right?
Exactly. Well, I feel that we are a decade or two at the most away from CRISPR or a technology very much like it making, you know, all treatment of cancer or so many different things just very routine. Right. I honestly believe that. I think we're going to see breakthroughs that are just going to be dazzling. They're just going to be mind blowing in the next few years because of the precision and the ability, you know, the level of control that we're going to have over this stuff because of tools like this over the next few years. So,
I mean,
all
we're talking about is debugging a program. I mean, it's as simple as that. But we got to learn how to learn the programming language and get in there and do it. That's what we're talking about.
And if, you know, we need to try it, we should try it on people where, you know, what's the worst that can happen? It doesn't work. What was going to happen anyway? I mean, it really puzzles me how this is that hard ethically. You know, I mean, I don't understand why, you know, why that's hard.
In fact, there's an ethical argument to be made that to not do that is unethical. You know,
that's where I look at it. Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't want to be subjecting, you know, people to a lot of hypothetical treatments. You know what I'm saying? You know, for ailments they don't have, right? But people who are dying, and you don't have anything that's guaranteed to work or even, you know, likely to work. It seems like, well,
yeah.
If you got something that might, you try that, right? I don't know. We need to get a philosopher on the show to explain how this has even become a quandary for people. Because it seems to me that the Chinese are on board, right? They look at it and they see it the same way you and I see it, right? It's like,
yeah.
Well, what else have we got for this guy? Let's try this. And I think a few good examples of what else have we got for this person, let's try this, is not only going to provide positive outcomes for some of these patients, thank God, you know, save some of these people, but it's also going to push us rapidly on the road to the scenario I just described, which is when this becomes routine. I mean,
when you get a diagnosis, they go, you know what, Stephen, you've got cancer, and I'll go, oh, well, crap, that's bad news. Well, how quickly can we get this problem fixed? You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, it's it goes from being a death sentence, you know, from, you know, it's not quite the death sentence it was when I was a kid, but
right.
You know,
but lung cancer,
but
is
even
bad.
Even now,
you know,
it's a pretty scary thing
points.
To hear the C word, right? If from your doctor,
oh yeah,
so
especially something like lung cancer. You know, if you hear you got lung cancer or pancreatic cancer, that is serious stuff, right?
Yeah, that's some serious stuff. Yeah, so. If you get word like that, then hey, you know, you want to move quickly from the world we're living in now to the world where it can be it's a bit of a hassle. You may have to take a month or so off from work, but we can get this thing into remission pretty quick, kind of thing.
Yeah,
because we
know
what
exactly.
We're doing now. Yeah,
I mean, when people get a diagnosis of cancer. And it has about the same impact of you got to have a root canal today, right? Then we know we've arrived. And I think we'll get there. I really do. I think that that we're on our way there. That's why this is exciting. I think it's exciting, actually. Maybe it's even better that it happened in China, because maybe that lights a fire here. I hope it does.
Maybe so. Well, let's not forget the last story we have, Phil. I want to get to it before the end of the program. The world's first brain implant is letting a locked-in woman communicate. Wow, that's a huge deal, right?
You want to talk about progress? This is really impressive. One of the things that's so impressive to me about this story is that this is improvement on what is already an amazing set of technologies. Basically, we're talking about a paralyzed woman who currently communicates with the world through eye movements. She, you know, by moving her eyes, she's able to designate letters and spell out words, and this is, you know, this is her interface with the world. Well, she has a severe form of, oh gosh, I can't remember, was it Lou Gehrig's disease? It's I think it was ALS. That it's progressive, and she's losing the ability even to move her eyes. Okay, but her brain still works. The brain is still working fine. How can she continue to communicate? And, well, the way is by thinking. And, in fact, the way this works is by imagining herself selecting letters from a list of letters being presented to her. She's able to spell out words. It's, you know, it's very crude and very slow at first, but the only thing going on here when it works is her brain waves, right? Basically, her neural activity is being read, it's being translated, and what she's thinking is being turned into letters that are being turned into words that are, you know, enabling her to communicate with the rest of the world. It's ESP, right? I mean, this is telepathy by other means, basically.
And it means everything to a patient like this. You know, I mean, that's you know, to be cut off from from the rest of the world, how frightening that must be for locked in patients. You know, I can't imagine. I just can't imagine. And it means the world to her, but think also what it could mean to other, you know, for other people. I mean, this sort of interface could allow the blind people to see. You know, I mean, it's you know, and perhaps even could allow at some point paralyzed people to walk again. This is, you know, brain interfaces are going to be a huge thing for patients, and maybe eventually for people that are not sick but need the ability to, you know, plug in more directly. You know, matrix style perhaps. But it's a huge deal.
It really is. The thing that these brain machine interfaces are doing is they're overcoming the limitations of physical damage, you know, to the body. We can't necessarily some things we can repair, some things we can't. And there's been this tremendous progress anyway over the years. I mean, even from like the 70s on, they were thinking of ways that quadriplegics could communicate with people. You know, there were these keyboards operated by the tongue, right? Coming up to somebody could tilt their head and it would mean something. All the way to we can track eye movements and it will mean something. So that
what Professor Hawking is doing these days.
That's right. Yeah. So that you know, increasingly more and more intense forms of paralysis, more and more debilitating paralysis, would not be a barrier. And finally, it's like, you can't move anything, not even your eyes. How do you communicate? It's like, well, here's how. We're going to plug straight into the brain. And we've been talking about other things that are happening around the brain in terms of turning thought activity in the brain into, as you said, kinetic energy, turning it into people being able to move parts of their body that previously they couldn't because of damage in the spine. Yeah. You look at all of these things coming together, and it paints a very hopeful picture for people suffering from a host of different kinds of problems, but in particular for those who are, you know, dealing with extreme forms of paralysis. It's a wonderful story. It's a great story to close this show on, isn't it?
Amazing story. This is our amazing Wednesday. So.
It's amazing Wednesday, and if you haven't been amazed by the other things we've talked about, you should be amazed by this. Someone who cannot move, cannot speak, cannot move, can still communicate with the outside world. And with that, Stephen, I'll say happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
And to yours as well, Phil. I hope you have a great one tomorrow. And
thank you very much. And
talk to you on Friday.
Thank you all for being with us. We're going to be back on Black Friday. We've got a brand new show. We're going to wrap up our Signs of Progress. And we're going to talk about, everybody off the planet. So you're not going to want to miss that. We look forward to being with you all then. And until next time, live to see it.